Right, well, now it's time to welcome back my old friend Francis Clamp. So, hello and welcome back, Francis.
It's nice to be back again.
It's good to see you, I have to tell you. Now, Francis has just completed a book all about the Great War, but not just any book, as this one concentrates on Southend-on-Sea. Now, I know you used to live there, Francis, but was that the reason that you actually chose to concentrate on that town in particular?
No, not really. I was born there, so I felt I knew the town quite well. But I knew that the publishers wanted some books on the seaside, seaside towns. And, of course, knowing Southend, it seemed ideal.
Right. So you threw yourself into this. Now, the book itself, you're going right back to the beginning. How was the news of the war greeted in Southend? Was it the same way of the euphoria that was seen in London?
Certainly not. We've got to remember that you didn't have radio, television or anything like that as you do now. So really people got the news by going down to the Southend Standard offices and looking at the news announced in the window. And they were stunned because, like most of us, we believe nasty things are never going to really happen. We know that they're lurking somewhere in the background. But I don't think the majority of people really thought it would happen and would affect them.
Now, is it correct? I understood that in Southend in particular, that the news, when it did come out in the local paper, was something like page 5 or page 6. It wasn't even on the front page.
No, I don't think it was. But as time went on, obviously, it dominated things. Because the way the paper was set out was very different in those days. So you really had to go well through to find the most important news anyway.
Well, of course, it's only back in, what, the 70s, it might have been a bit before that, that the Times started putting headlines on the front page.
Well, yes.
Adverts.
I admit I did a lot of research in Southend Library looking at the old microfiche records of the Southend Standard from the years of the war, which is fascinating because the writers wrote in such a peculiar way by our standards.
Well, that's right. Now, I wouldn't have thought that too many people would have considered Southend be very important in the eyes of the Germans, but not so.
No. Well, it was funny because when I talked to my grandson about doing this and he was just setting off for university, he said, "Southend? Well, that's a seaside town. What's that got to do with war?" Well, Southend to the east had the Shrewsbury garrison. To the north, there was an airfield that was developed during the First World War. We weren't that far from London. And, of course, to the south, with the Thames, you had the longest pleasure pier in the world, which was used for troops going over to France. And, of course, things could be delivered on the pier. So nobody wanted to blow the middle up and abandon it. They wanted to keep it.
Of course they did. Yeah, gold mine. And what about... Now, is it true that there were prison ships that were moored at the end of the pier?
Yes, there were. There were three of them. And they weren't there for terribly long. They didn't even stay there, I don't think, for a full year.
Oh, really?
Yep. And the people who were going to go on them, the poor old prisoners, these were people who were interned locally, some of them had been shopkeepers, had been good citizens, but they were marched down the high street and all the way along the pier, or mile and a third of it, I think it is.
They didn't get the train then, they had to
they
walk.
They didn't get the train.
Yeah.
There was a train, but they didn't use it, not as it has been in more recent years. And then there were these three ships, and they were more fairly close. But, of course, some of the bombs that came were really aiming for the pier. So those ships could very easily have been hit.
So they could have sunk their own people.
Well, exactly.
Yeah, yeah.
And they were moved fairly quickly away to other camps.
What, back in the mainland?
Yes.
Yeah, yeah. Now, is it right that people, that these people actually paid for accommodation on there?
Yes.
That's extraordinary.
If you'd got a fair bit of money, you know, you could have better food and better accommodation. But if you were a bit broke, then you'd be in steerage and you'd be in bunks that were in tiers of three. So it's a strange situation. But you can see the point, because, I mean, obviously, but ships weren't adapted so that everybody could be in the same kind of cabin.
Yes.
So
yeah.
They're always out for money.
Yeah, they didn't mind taking the money from the enemy, that's for sure. Yeah. Okay, now, I believe the book itself actually looks at the lives of ordinary people who had to cope with the new and unexpected problems that arose. And that must have also affected businesses as well, so...
It did, tremendously. I mean, we always think about particularly food shops being affected, but all shops were. Because with submarines, U-boats in those days, attacking shipping, things that we'd taken for granted weren't still coming in. And though I've written about Southend, so many of these things affected the whole country.
Of course, they would have done that, and presumably that would have had an effect on rationing. But I don't think that came in right at the beginning, did it? Although there were price hikes.
Well, rationing came in quite slowly, actually, because most of it was very late in the war. But things disappeared from shops, and so shops did organise their own forms of rationing. You're a regular, so. And they of cut down things.
Yes.
So you couldn't buy as much as you had previously. But it wasn't rationing as it was in the Second World War.
But I think there were quite a lot of price hikes that came in.
Oh, yes.
Yes. I think the mayor of Southend wasn't too happy about that.
The mayor of Southend must have really worked his socks off the whole time. He kept coming up in these records of what happened. And, I mean, the poor man must have bitterly regretted for becoming mayor at that point.
Well, there's a lesson to be learnt there, I guess. What about now, Southend itself? Did it stay as a leisure centre as well?
Well, it did and it didn't. Some people were very worried about travel. And so they weren't still coming to the town as they used to. Some of the big hotels, quite a number of them, had been turned into hospitals, particularly the old Palace Hotel, which became Queen Mary Royal Naval Hospital.
Right.
And on the front of the book, I have a picture there of the hospital taken during the war with the wounded standing on the balcony and people gathering round below, and they used to let down baskets, boxes and things. People would put in money, cigarettes, very important cigarettes, and nice food items. So those hotels weren't used as they had been previously, obviously. But Southend was very much a day tripper town. And of course people didn't like travelling too much. And there were restrictions on car travel. Trains were used, and towards the end of the war, people began to get a little bit slack and think, oh yes, we can spend a nice day in Southend. And that's where we came to one of the most horrendous stories of the war.
Which is?
That is, on the 12th of August 1917, it was a Sunday. It was a bit cloudy, but it was a nice day. And a lot of people had decided that it would be worth going down to the town to spend a day on the beach. So they did. And towards 5 o'clock, they heard planes going over. It's thought that these originally were going up to London, but they got sent back and they dropped their bombs instead over Southend, mainly in the High Street, and also very close to Victoria Station. In all, 32 people were killed, 10 of them men, 13 women, 9 children, 43 were injured. And I talked to a couple of people who had relatives who were there on that day. And one of them described how from Garin's Bakery they brought out baskets to put in the body parts.
Oh, my goodness me.
Which tells you something about what Southend was like. So other towns may have had things that were worse in some ways. But for Southend, on a day when people were going down to the seaside, that was absolutely horrendous.
I mean, do you know, I mean, you've got very precise figures there, but do you know how many of those people were visitors to the town and how many were residents?
There are statistics for that.
Sorry, I threw that one at you.
I haven't got in front of me. It's in the book. So you have to buy the book and read it.
Oh, that's reasonable
when it's
enough.
Available. That was a good plug, wasn't it?
Well, I'm very impressed with that. Now, I guess in any event, as time went on, a lot of things changed.
Yes, they did, and particularly the role of women. Hmm. You hear this time and time again. I mean, television radio programmes have been saturated with stories of the First World War. Hmm. But particularly the role of women through the suffragettes. They'd been fighting for equality and all that sort of thing for a very long time.
Yes.
But everything changed with the war.
Well, I guess that would be because of conscription.
Absolutely.
But that didn't come in straight at the beginning,
didn't
it? It
didn't until very late.
Yeah.
But an awful lot of the letters that were sent back from soldiers were begging people to go to fill in the gaps in the lines. Well, I mean, if you were filling in the gaps, what were you filling them in for?
Well,
to be the next one down.
Yes, the next one down. Yeah, absolutely. So I would imagine that was pretty horrendous. Now, you mentioned that rationing was brought in, but it didn't come in until much later.
No, that came in very late in the war. But what they did try to do was get everybody to use every bit of land they could to grow vegetables. And when there was some bombing, houses in Lee had their windows broken. Mm. And when they got back into their houses, they discovered that they'd got vegetables all over the place because the bombs had landed on the vegetable plots.
Yes.
And had dug up the vegetables for them and sent them through the windows.
Good grief.
Mind you, I think you'd have had to have been a little bit careful not to get the glass from the windows in your potatoes.
Probably a few bits of munitions as well.
And, of course, they did have endless committees. And one lot of committees were to try and persuade people to dig up every bit of garden to grow vegetables.
Hmm. Now, obviously, as the war rolled on and life became more difficult, but what happened as the war ended? Because it didn't. Again, a bit like the beginning of the war, it didn't. The end wasn't obvious, was it?
No, people didn't really realise at first, and eventually, after the armistice was signed, even so, things didn't get back to normal immediately. They never do they?
No.
After this sort of thing. And, yes, they sort of half believed it and then didn't quite believe it. Hmm. So there were hooters going, but they carried on going. So they began to realise that something different was happening. And then gradually they started celebrating.
Hmm.
And yes, I mean, there was one story at one point they used South Church Park for training soldiers, but they didn't allow any soldiers to go on the actual batting
the
green pitch. And, you know, it's the middle of war,
yes,
and you can train your soldiers, but they mustn't drill where the cricketer's going to play. And after the war, they did play a cricket match on it, so they're quite glad they preserved it.
Now, I'm going to bowl you a real fastball with topspin. There's something I saw today, and I'm just curious to know whether any of this ever happened to the best of your knowledge in Essex. I was amazed to see that Belgians that came across from Belgium, obviously, at the beginning of the First World War, got little areas of the country which actually were considered to be Belgian territory.
Well,
did
certainly
they have anything like that in Essex?
Not that I've heard of, but the Old Palace Hotel, the Queen Mary Royal Naval Hospital, was very much used to start with, particularly for those from Belgium who had been wounded, because there were a lot of them, and they were brought over. And there's one story in the book of a man who had come over to visit his brother. Mm. And he did say that he was so impressed by the people of Southend and how friendly and helpful they were. So all Southenders, all Essex people, sit back and feel good.
Sounds good to me. Now, one other thing which I noticed in your book was something about a POW camp that was placed in an area that was fairly close to where it might be attacked.
Yes. I think this had happened because apparently some English officers were put in very, very vulnerable positions in their camps. And so there was a camp in Victoria Avenue. But when we were doing our research, my husband found one book that said nobody knows where the camp was. Well, I do know where the camp was, because when I was doing an earlier book, somebody said that as a very small child, he'd been on a tram and looked down in Victoria Avenue on a house called Belfields. And that was an officer's prison of war camp. And after the war, it became the first building used by Westcliff High School for boys and girls. Then it became the centre for the crematorium and cemetery department. Then they knocked it down and built the civic centre on the site. So you won't find it now, but that's where it was.
Well, well, well. Well, look, Frances, this is absolutely fascinating stuff. I'd expect nothing less from you, of course.
Oh, I like that.
But come on, now you can do your real plug for your book. What's it called? Where can you get it? And how much is it?
This is Southend-on-Sea and the Great War. Mm-hmm. Why is it called the Great War, somebody asked me, and not the First World War? Because there hadn't been a Second World War, and nobody knew at that time there was going to be. This was going to be the war to end all wars.
So it's
the Great War. And it's published by Pen and Sword, who do an awful lot of military histories. It will cost £9.99. It will be available on Amazon and places like that, because I've already looked it up on the internet and it's there. But it will be out next month. It should be out early in October, but it might not be till later, because if you look on the internet, Amazon says it's the 31st of October, but I think it'll be earlier than that.
All right.
Should be in Waterstones, should be in W.H. Smith's. And, you know, large bookshops, really, and the library.
And are you anticipating that there's also going to be a Kindle version, or is it just a proper book, as I would classify?
I don't know.
Yeah.
I must admit, I like holding proper
books.
So
do I.
But just what they do, I'm not quite sure, because I haven't worked for this publisher before.
Right. All right. Well, look, that's it. I think it's an absolutely sensational book. I've read it very quickly, I have to say, but I did read it and I thought it was very, very good indeed. And I should be going back and reading it a little bit closer as well before too long. Thanks ever so much for coming in.
Thank you.